Well, sometimes when we look at a passage for Sunday, we have to back up and see where the characters in the story were coming from to understand some of the meaning and potential that this passage holds. The Bible records that Jacob and Esau, twins, came out of the womb fighting, that Jacob literally was grabbing onto the heel of his brother as he was leaving the womb, and the fighting really never stopped. And what was interesting was that it was spurred on often by the parents. Esau was the favorite child for his father, Isaac, and Jacob, was the pet of his mother, Rebekah. And they were constantly pitted against one another, and their hostility towards one another continually grew until Rebekah was afraid that Esau would murder Jacob, and in the story was encouraging him to flee for his life. But what can we say about Jacob? Let's review for a moment. Jacob has long been cast as a man who cheated his brother out of his birthright. A scoundrel, we might call him. But is it really true? Perhaps he was just a very shrewd businessman. Let's consider this possibility. Esau came in terribly hungry one day for food, and Jacob had food. Esau was hungry enough that he felt that he would die if he didn't eat. Now, I don't know if that's true. I know as a woman, I get to that place where I feel like I could die if I'm not going to eat, but I'm quite sure that I will survive another few hours at least. But he took advantage of his state. And while you might say that he was cruel and a horrible human being, let alone a brother, he actually didn't cheat his brother at that moment. His brother agreed to the trade. And let's just say if you can convince a new salesman to take your beat-up 1995 Nissan Sentra and trade it for a 2017 Ferrari, you are some combination of shrewd and lucky, and the new salesman is some combination of unemployed and poor. But if you're actually able to make that kind of a trade, in this culture, we would actually kind of think that was a good idea. That was a shrewd deal. And that was the kind of deal that was made. So as we follow the story along, Esau was scheduled to meet his father for a blessing, something that was traditionally part of the birthright that had already been traded. But Esau had failed to mention that he had sold it to his brother, and Jacob, at the urging of his mother, disguised himself as Esau and took his father's blessing. Jacob himself didn't think that was a good idea, because if he had been found out, his father, instead of blessing him, may actually have cursed him and had the opposite experience. And it is hard in our culture to understand what the reception of a blessing or curse from your father would mean. I tried very hard to think of a cultural equivalent, but it's one of those things that in some ways stands alone. Jacob had somewhat already legitimately received the inheritance, but he didn't have the courage to stand up to his father and say, I should also, as part of that inheritance, received the blessing, and instead took advantage of his father's blindness and covered himself in animal fur so that his father would think that he was the much more hairier-skinned brother. But that left Jacob running. That left Jacob in fear for his life. He was a dysfunctional family member running from a dysfunctional family. And I'm sure none of you know anything about dysfunctional families, right? And my sister and I say, my family has our own unique brand of dysfunction. And I think we all do. But here's the good news. God shows a dysfunctional family to promise and to continue to promise his everlasting presence and promise. When Jacob was out in that desert, alone place, that is the promise that God brought to him, is that his line would continue, his presence and his family would continue to be part of God's plan. So Jacob should have been one of the richest, most powerful men in his time. He not only had his father's blessing, but the entire substantial inheritance of his father. And instead, he found himself too exhausted to go any farther, and without even the essentials to make a bed and a rock for his head. He was in one of the hard places. And to make matters worse, Jacob was very much alone. Traveling in ancient times was normally done in tribes and groups, with families, with people along to protect you. So being alone was probably very foreign to Jacob. And if you read ahead in the book of Genesis, when Jacob was traveling back to meet Esau with great fear and trepidation for all of his past sins and grievous errors with his brother, he traveled with company that he eventually split up so that he could make sure that at least some of his company would survive if Esau's anger continued against him. And he heard from his lookouts that Esau was traveling with 400 people back towards Jacob. And that was the way you traveled in ancient times, with your clan, with your people. So for Jacob to be so alone was really a foreign experience. So alone, tired, this time he's cold and he's hungry, Jacob can only pull up a rock for a pillow. But he wasn't as alone as he thought he was. God came to Jacob in a dream, and the dream is significant for all of us because every one of us has had that hard place. When we've laid down at night and wondered what tomorrow holds, when we've laid down at night and thought, I can't believe I've made it through this day, but I don't know where I'm going tomorrow. Every one of us is running from something or someone. We may be physically running in fear, but we also may be running from our memories, from our own dysfunctions, from those who had hurt us, real or imagined. And I believe we live in a culture that seems to be constantly running rather than listening to what God would have us say. So if we believe that dreams are the forgotten language of God, what does God show us in Jacob's dream? He showed Jacob that there is an unending flow from heaven to earth and back again. I find it somewhat disappointing that many of the hymns talk about climbing up to God on Jacob's ladder, and they forget to mention that the angels were coming up and down, that there was this circular experience of God and God's coming to us. The ladder is full of heavenly beings circling down from heaven and back up again. We talk about the mountaintop for a faith experience. We talk about reaching up to God, but we need to talk about God climbing down to us, reaching down to us, being permanently and intricately connected with each one of us. When we are in hard places, when we are too exhausted to go on, when we are feeling isolated and alone, when we feel as if the darkness of night is overwhelming and there is no one to protect us, Jacob's ladder reminds us that God is present to us in every moment. Not only is God present to us, but we don't have to climb. God comes down. God came down to Jacob, and God came down to us in Jesus, in Bethlehem, in a stable, in the place of deepest despair. When Jacob awoke, he proclaimed, "Surely the Lord was in this place, and I did not know it." Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Where are the places that you long to see God? There are places that you are sure that God is absent. Perhaps we need to adopt the mindset that surely God is in this place, and we didn't know it. God is in the hospital rooms, the lonely apartments, the traffic jams. Yes, the traffic jams. When you're sitting there wanting to just curse the traffic, God is in that place. God is in the dysfunctional family fights, the mundane jobs of life, and we simply didn't know. Surely God is in the place of terrorist activities and politically corrupt governments and disasters of all kinds, and we didn't know it. Surely God is in the family courtrooms and the bankruptcy protection plans, and we didn't know it. Surely God is in the disasters and the accidents, big and small, and we simply didn't know it. The reaction of Jacob was interesting. He was afraid. And I went and I looked up all my different versions of the Bible, and I thought, why are you afraid if God is present? And many versions use the word terrified, scared, frightened. And I thought, why? Part of it, I think, is the unknown is always frightening to us. But then as I began to explore, I realized that in Jacob's time, God was not located everywhere the way that we think of God. God was geographically located and did not transcend time and space the way that we conceptualize God. God was located in the tabernacle, in the land, and later in the temple. But he was not just found anywhere and everywhere. If one wanted to encounter God, you had to be geographically located in the place where God would be. So when Jacob discovered that God was in a place that he hadn't been identified as geographically located, he was frightened. God was no longer contained in Jacob's world. God was unleashed. God wasn't where Jacob expected him to be. God wasn't following the rules that we thought God had made in the first place. And I think we all have rules for where God will be found and where God will not be found. Jacob was running and he discovered that God ran with him. In fact, unlike the psalmist in Psalm 139, where he says, "Where can I go? Where can I flee from your presence?" It's interesting that we don't read about Jacob actually looking for God. Jacob basically was running under the assumption that God was not with him. And when Jacob fell off in an exhausted sleep, he found God in his dreams. Jacob made mistakes, but there was no mistake that he could make that excluded him from God. In fact, if you keep reading Jacob's story, he continues to make many, many more mistakes. He suffers from poor choices. He makes many more enemies, and he hurts and offends those around him all over the place. And I'm grateful for that because I know that God is still with me, that God still loves me, even when I make those mistakes. So Jacob's choice was to make an altar. He made an altar to mark the place where he found God. Ultimately, our stories of faith call us to find God in hard places and to create an altar in our world to remind us that God is not where we expected to find God, and it is upon those altars in the landscape of our faith that we worship. What does it mean to build an altar in the world each time we find God in unexpected places? We are running, but we are always running to God, whether we see it or not. We are scared, but we are always scared by God. We are surprised by God, and we build an altar to remember that God is here in this place. So let us build altars in our courtrooms, in the food banks, in the government buildings, in the hard places in our lives. Amen. When Jacob recognized that God was in a place and didn't know it, he built an altar. What would it mean for this congregation to build altars in unexpected places? Where don't we expect God to be? We should go looking for God in those places. And the offering plate is where we commit to build in those places. Let us take up our morning offering.